over time, just because there were no actions, everyone just gave up and they all tried working around it. But I knew that that was a big opportunity where if we knew those problems from the people who were actually working there, and if we started solving those problems one by one, we would be in a much better state.
Pashi presents The Means of Production, a podcast about what it really takes to build, maintain, and scale the processes that produce the physical products that power our world. Every episode, we ask a manufacturing expert to walk us through the nuts and bolts of how they do their job. We explore how and why they got into manufacturing, dive deep into the hardest problems they've solved on production lines, and discuss their thoughts on what's broken in manufacturing today and how those things can be fixed. This podcast is hosted by me, Sidith Sanghvi, Pashi's US Manufacturing Operations Lead and former assembly engineer at Ford Motor Company. If you are a part of the manufacturing world and you're interested in being a guest on The Means of Production, get in touch with me at sidith@pashi.com, which is sidith@pashi.com. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 8 of The Means of Production. With us today is my friend and former college batchmate, Abhishek Patel, who is also the program manager at Ryder Supply Chain Solutions. So, welcome, Abhishek.
Yes, Adit. Thanks for having me here. I look forward to having this conversation as well.
So, before we get started, a quick disclaimer from Abhishek.
I work at Ryder, but this is my own opinion and it's not the opinion of Ryder. I'm not a spokesperson for Ryder, official or otherwise.
Thanks, Abhishek. So we've talked after a long time, Abhishek. So I'm very glad to catch up with you. Through this podcast, I've reconnected with a lot of people, and one of them is you, and you're on our podcast now. So welcome. Before we get started, just tell us what do you do these days? How are you handling the COVID situation? How is your family? How is work?
So I'm doing well. I know the COVID is almost over, hopefully, as we all are getting our vaccine shots. So initially, when the COVID started, the lockdown started, it was really tough where I had to. So my position is usually on site, so I had to work remotely. At the same time, my wife, she was working remotely as well. And then we had to take care of my son. So it got challenging initially, but now slowly, we have been getting used to it. But now it seems like things are getting better. I have started going back to my work. So it was a different experience for sure. I'm sure it was the same for everyone. But we got through it. So yeah, doing well. Looking forward to going back to normal.
Glad to hear that, Abhishek. And glad everyone is safe on your side as well. Yeah, it's been very challenging, and this is why I just, you know, make sure I ask everyone how they're doing, because we seem to have come out of it, but it's, you know, who knows what someone has faced in this situation. So tell us a little bit about, like, what you do, Abhishek, at Ryder.
Yes, absolutely. So at Ryder, I'm a continuous improvement engineer lead, so I mainly support all the continuous improvement activities for the location. So Ryder is a third-party logistics company. So Ryder supports the business for Verizon. So down here, being a lead, I take care of a lot of activities around trying to look for opportunities to improve a process or reduce costs or make a certain process efficient. So high level, we would look for opportunities in different areas of the operation. And then once these opportunities are found, the team would determine which ones are good. So the team would go through a prioritization effort to make sure we are focusing our efforts on the right activities. So down there, once we identify which projects are worth working on, they would either be broken down either as a just do it or a Kaizen or a project, but depending on what kind of problem we are trying to solve. And then all these would happen.
Hey Abhishek.
Yes.
Can you just say, like, elaborate on those three different types of problems that you just mentioned?
Okay. And I think I'll also talk about the transformation planning high level as what it is. And
yeah, sure.
The mapping session. Okay.
Sure.
So So being a continuous improvement engineer lead, what we do every year is we would meet as a team from members from all the different areas within the operation, also the customer. By customer, I mean Verizon. So we would map the current state of the operation right from all the inbound side. So this is a warehousing operation. So we receive a lot of products from original equipment manufacturers, receive it, store it in the racks. And then whenever there's a request from a particular customer, we pick it and then ship it. So high level, this is a process. So we would just map the current state of what the operation is. And then after mapping the current state, the team would start brainstorming different ideas to look for ways to eliminate any non-value-added activities or waste in the process. So we use a process like the 7 wastes in Lean. So we would use that as a North Star to identify any opportunities where we could eliminate a step from a process or a waste from a process. From there, the team would identify a list of improvement ideas. So these ideas would either be broken down either as Kaizen. So Kaizen is something where there's a problem that the team wants to solve, and then there'll be a small team which would get together, and then the team would try to solve the problem and come up with improvements and make the changes right away. So this activity would be taken over like 3 to 4 days. So that's a Kaizen. But if it's like a project where a big systemic change is required or someone has a better idea, so that could be identified as a project. And also there's third category which we have, which is a Just Do It. Just Do It is something which is very simple and that can be done quickly and does not make any sense to have a big plan in place when you could just implement a change right away. So the team defines these ideas into 3 different buckets. And then using a prioritization effort, which is a 9 block process, is what Ryder calls it as, is basically the team would get together, brainstorm, and then put these different ideas into different buckets. And then the metrics we would use to define these would be either how much it's going to cost to make this change or how much effort is required. So once we put all these different ideas into different blocks, the team would mainly focus on ideas which have a high impact and low effort, which is something which would either save the company a lot of money in terms of reducing costs, or it would improve a certain process drastically. So once these have been prioritized, the team would come together and create like a roadmap per se for the whole year, saying these are the activities we think would make most sense, and then we would try to come up with a timeline as to which activities we could work when based on the number of resources we have. And then again, doesn't mean that if any idea that goes on that list means that it's going to be worked for sure. Whenever the time comes, someone would look into that problem to see if it's truly worth solving at that point, because things could have changed between now and then whenever that the time would come. So at that time, it would be analyzed further. And then if there's a good opportunity there, if there's a good ROI in that in solving that problem, then the team would work further into it. So that's where I would also play a role in terms of managing the project right from the initiation, which is where the idea was created, to launch. So I would take the whole idea from the concept phase to the launch phase. So that's what I mainly do high level. So I've been with this company for 3.5 years now. So this is something I have been doing for quite some time now. So I've been enjoying it so far.
That's great. That's great to hear. And the concept of Just Do It seems very interesting. At first, I thought you said just in time, but then when you restated it, I heard that it was Just Do It. And that is very interesting, because essentially what you are saying is that this would not require any kind of permissions or going up the hierarchy and saying, can I do this? Can I do this? It would just mean that if it makes enough sense, you would just simply spring into action and implement the changes. So just curious about that. When something falls under Just Do It, does that mean that you as the lead have like the full freedom to make the physical changes in the warehouse or spend a certain budget or make some process changes in the way things are done there and then? Is that how you do things in the Just Do It category?
Yes, high level, yes. So the way we define something as Just Do It is something which would not be very expensive to make that change. It's something as simple as moving a certain product from one location to another location just because it just didn't make sense to have someone travel so much. So that was like a quick change. So rather than going through a detailed analysis as to why the current state and the future state are different and why there's improvement, it's just logical trying to follow some lean guiding principles. So rather than trying to prove that each idea is a good idea, sometimes we just try to follow these guiding principles saying that if something is causing excess amount of travel, which is a waste, and if you could, there's a better way of doing it just by moving it from one spot to a different spot, rather than going through a detailed analysis to prove why is it this better, you just do it. So that's the concept behind it.
Okay, so it's like a low-hanging fruit that you've identified and it's very easy to implement and you just finish it off without any kind of bureaucracy involved, any kind of steps involved. That's pretty effective in these kind of situations where you're trying to add value. I think that becomes very helpful because sometimes trying to get the permissions itself, you know, wipes out some of the value, right? The time it takes to act on this. So that's a very smart thing you'll do at Rider. So thanks for that answer and introduction to what you do, Abhishek. So let's get down to our format, which is how did you get to this position and in this industry and what was that journey like?
So I can go back to like how it all started maybe. So in my career, I was, currently I'm in supply chain industry, which is distribution warehousing, but I was not in this when I just started. I started with manufacturing actually. So again, trying to go back to how I entered into manufacturing, is that something you want me to share or?
Yeah. You can, okay. You can, you know, trace the whole journey because, you know, for people listening to this, especially young people, they might think, you know, how did Abhishek go from college, you know, where we both were studying together, to a supply chain company, or how did he go to Caterpillar or what have you? Like, how was that process? So you can elaborate as much as you feel like.
Sure. So I'll begin from when I came to like United States. So I did my master's in manufacturing systems engineering from NC State University. So right out of college, during my master's program, I actually had an opportunity to work for my internship with the Bosch and Siemens Home Appliances, which was basically like I spent like almost a year there as an intern. And then right after that, got into Caterpillar as a manufacturing engineer. But down there, I was also working as a new product launch program manager process. So down there, I was supporting a team to launch a new generation of construction equipments, which would help reduce like the emission by almost by 95%. So that was something like a tier 4 emission model. So it required a completely new design. So I was supporting that team to launch these products, but from an assembly and manufacturing side. But I had, since it was like a whole product development life cycle, I was working with the design team to provide inputs, which would help eliminate a lot of assembly time. So trying to provide inputs from an assembly perspective as to if certain design could be changed in a certain way, it could help eliminate the assembly time by X amount of time. So trying to make those changes. So it's basically a design for assembly is what the term we were using. So trying to design a product with assembly in mind so that you're not designing something which would cause excess amount of time just trying to assemble something. So which is where the company would save a lot of like cost in terms of labor, trying to reduce the time it required to assemble something. So I spent a lot of time down there as a manufacturing engineer, and then gradually I started getting interested in supply chain. So I know it was a big change for me in terms of moving from manufacturing to supply chain, but I started like reaching out to people on LinkedIn just to find an opportunity in supply chain, and finally being able to use a lot of concepts in manufacturing, which is like lean manufacturing. But at that time, it was really new on the supply chain side and in the warehousing side. So I was able to use that knowledge and experience from manufacturing and applying to supply chain side. So finally, I got that opportunity while working with a company called Lean Core Supply Chain Solution, which was a consulting company, which was actually trying to work with a number of different customers, trying to share the knowledge of Lean as to how Lean could help on the distribution supply chain side, as to how waste were also present in that industry as well. And if the concept were applied from the manufacturing of the companies could see a lot of benefits in terms of reducing costs or making processes efficient. So that's where I got the opportunity. I pivoted from being a manufacturing engineer to being a senior supply chain engineer. And then after that, I got an opportunity with Ryder. So that's how it all started.
Yeah, and I've heard of this transformation taken by some other, you know, friends and colleagues as well, because these are very related fields and they often have the same requirement of optimizing, right? They both manufacturing operations as well as supply chain operations need optimization. They need a lot of calculation in terms of how you can squeeze the most amount of value from the least amount of resources. So right. I completely get that. And it's a great field to be in. And even when I was at Virginia Tech, I saw those subjects and I wasn't as interested in supply chain, but there were some pretty interesting subjects on supply chain. And I saw several great problems being solved by, you know, some of my batchmates there and good companies, you know, requiring supply chain engineers. And both of these fields are very physical. They're very in-person. They're very hard. So again, the same aptitude or attitude would be required for both of them. I'm sure you're spending a lot of time in the warehouse as you were spending on the shop floor when you were in manufacturing. So that makes perfect sense that, you know, you could pivot from one to the other. So yeah, that's pretty comprehensive, Abhishek, how you laid it out. So thank you for that. And you've been through, you know, these different jobs. You've been through Caterpillar, which is very manufacturing, right? It's assembly of all of these heavy equipment, and some of the steps you said, you know, design for manufacturing. And I think in Ford and some other places, we call it manufacturability. Right. It's the same thing. It just says that if you make something that's hard to assemble, it's going to lead to quality issues, and you take that feedback back to this. But it seems like in Caterpillar, there was a very tight feedback loop between product development and the shop floor, where you can quickly tell them that, you know, this is not really going, you know, for or this is not really helping with design to assemble. So. Right. So that's pretty good to see. It's not always that a product development and production are able to talk in the same language and design something that is very easy to manufacture. And sometimes it's not even possible. But I see all of these problems that you're solving. So can you talk to us about, you know, some problem or a set of problems which are very technical, and then you had to go ahead and face them, and maybe you solve them, maybe you're not able to solve them, but it is something that you remember even now. So walk us through that problem as if, you know, we were in your shoes.
This is a distribution and fulfillment center. So we'll fulfill orders for Verizon garage work centers is what we call, as well as retail stores. So let's say you order something from Verizon, you need a new cable connection or you need new internet connection. You could either order it online or you could either go to a store and then have a technician come into the home. So this warehouse is basically where we would ship it, either or. We would either ship it to a technician, or we would directly ship it to an end customer, which is called like direct to consumer fulfillment. And this warehouse also supports like returns. So let's say you no longer want the service from Verizon, or you're upgrading to a new product and you want to send your set-top box or a router back. So all these returns would come through the Ryder facility, which is where the receiving operations or returns receiving operation would receive these products, which would come in like parcel boxes. So there are all kinds of boxes that come in. And then there's a set of workstations where someone would literally open up each box, get the products out, receive it into the system, and then so it'll be sorted based on where it's supposed to go. So there are like, let's say 50 different products that come in through the return receiving operation. So I was working in a team where we were trying to identify some opportunities to improve that process, just to make that process more efficient. What I did was I was actually working with a set of people from operations as well as from a solutions design team is what Rider refers to as. So solutions design is basically a team which helps with launching new processes or helps with designing a process for a new customer. So I was working with members from that team trying to look for opportunities in this returns receiving operation. So the way I started was to actually map what the current state process was. So trying to map that whole process down, creating a process flow map, and then looking for opportunities where we could eliminate some of the steps from the process or the number of touches. So when I say touches, it means that the number of times a product, from the time the product comes in, many times the product has to be touched until it's move to wherever it's supposed to go, either in storage or to a recycling vendor. So a lot of times these products would come in, and then based on how old this product is, it would either be stored in the racks to be processed further, or it could either be like, let's say it's too old, we don't need it anymore, so it's going to be sorted in a different area, which is what we call as scrap. So these products would go through a different recycling vendor where they would be recycled and try to be used for something else, per se, as an example. So trying to look for opportunities in this area, the team started brainstorming, and then we found certain areas where the end user or the associates which are actually touching these products were touching these units multiple times. So just trying to do like a discovery where trying to look like having open mind and look for ways to use technology to make this process more efficient. So we looked at ways like trying to use, when these products come in, a person has to literally open like each parcel box and then take the product, scan the product in, and then put it back on the conveyor, and then it goes down like 20 feet, and then down there someone would pick up the product again, and then they would move the product to like a trolley or per se, and then from there some other person would take the trolley and then scan the product, and then based on where it's supposed to go, which is the final home, they would just take the trolley, travel around that area, and then move it to its final location. So there were a lot of touches that were involved, in short. So we wanted to find a way to make that process more efficient. We look for an opportunity where we could actually use like a scan tunnel, is what we refer to as, meaning person would open the box, get the unit, and put it back on the conveyor, and then units would travel through like a MRI machine per se, like where there are scanners all over, like 360 degrees, just because based on all the different complexities with all the different products, the barcodes could be anywhere. So trying to capture the serial numbers. So we went that route. We're trying to see if that process made sense, and if it was cost efficient. So working with different vendors, getting cost estimates, and then finally we figured that from the benefit the team was going to get, which is basically eliminating like 2 seconds from the process, and from compared to the cost of which the team would be investing, it didn't make sense going that route. And also it required a lot of physical changes and within that receiving operation. So we decided to not go that route. Then we started looking at a different way of trying to use technology. So
wait.
This is where, yes.
Wait, so the initial plan, which was not feasible, was that it would have like lots of cameras on every site, so that is the idea that a person had to earlier pick it up, orient it, and then pick up a hand scanner and then scan it and then put it back. Is that part of the activities that y'all were trying to cut out with this implementation?
That is right. So the way current receiving operation worked was when the operator got the, let's say, router out of that box, we have Cognex scanners, which is like cameras. So they had to orient it in a certain way. So that was like, some excess movements that were involved in there.
Right.
And then after orienting in a certain way, it took like 2 to 3 seconds. And then once the product was received in, it was put back on the conveyor. And then the way we have this current process is, let's say the person is trying to receive it in, and let's say it's a scrap. Let's say we don't need it. The person would literally use a chalk and mark that unit, saying physically, it's going to be scrapped.
So wow, really?
Down there, down at the end, would see these units with a chalk mark on it, and then they would say, "Oh, this is a scrap, so I'm gonna sell it somewhere else." So we were spending like this time to the market or trying to orient it in a certain way. So trying to eliminate that time, and also these workstations were fixed, and we had like 6 workstations to receive it in, and just because we had like 50 different sorts, so there could be 50 different, like, you know, different items coming in. And the reason they had to put it back on the conveyor to go down like 20 feet where some other person would touch the product again is because of the number of sorts that were required. So it was physically not possible for each workstation to have these many like areas to put these products away because there were some physical constraints. So that's why they had to put it back on the conveyor, go down, and then someone else would pick it up, move it on the cart, and then they would pick it up again, scan it, and then based on what the system says it's supposed to go, they would move it to that final home and then scan a barcode just to confirm that it's going to the right location. So this was a challenge we had. The first design, as I said, was trying to eliminate those 2 or 3 seconds, but the cost was very expensive of having.
And then you were explaining like the other one. So sorry, that's when I interrupted you. And you were going to explain what you all did next. Please go on.
So the next we looked at was, so as I said, these workstations were fixed. And then just because they were fixed, we couldn't have the operator walk to a certain area. And then they had to go through a step where they had to put the units back on the conveyor to go down, you know, a certain amount of feet to be picked up again. So we were thinking, what if we try to make that operation like mobile, or, you know, something which could be easily moved, like using a scanner, handheld scanner or something. So we started looking at like using AR glasses, like the Google glasses is what everyone refers to as.
That's pretty cool.
These are augmented reality glasses. So we started looking into this technology by working with one of the solution vendors. So the concept was that instead of having these fixed workstations, the users would be wearing these glasses. So someone would still have to open up the boxes and put the units back in. But down when the units travel back on the back, the user would pick up these units, use the AR glasses to scan the serial numbers using the glasses. And then based on where it's supposed to go, they would either move it directly to the final pallet, final location, or if it's like a slow moving product, it would go to a 2-step process. So I did some analysis to understand the velocity of the products coming in. So I broke these products down into 2 different groups, high moving products and slow moving products. High moving products would go through a 1-step process where the user would pick it up, receive it in, and then directly go to its final home in one touch. But if it's like a slow moving product, it would go through a 2-step process where they would pick it up, receive it in, go to a cart, and then someone else would take the cart and then move it to its final home. But that was only for, let's say, 20% of the product. But 70 to 80% of the products would only go through a one touch process. So the team liked this concept. It made sense because performing this analysis further and the amount of time which would be saved with reducing a touch for 70% of the volume, we were looking at an improvement of almost 17% productivity improvement for this operation.
It's very, very, very cool what you just shared, especially like, you know, changing the whole like mechanism of how someone scans. Now, for me to understand this correctly, so when they wear these glasses, do they just look at the barcode and it gets automatically scanned, or how does that mechanism actually scan the barcode?
So there are 2 ways actually. So when you wear these glasses, it has a camera. So these AR glasses are essentially like smartphones, you know, sitting on a iframe. So there's an option of using the camera directly from these glasses, or you also have an option of having a ring scanner in it, which communicates. The main benefit we have with this is when the operator, let's say, tries to use a camera from the AR glasses, they pick up a certain product and then they look right into it. So there's a vision which is right in the top left or right corner based on where this screen is. You could literally see like a camera as to what you're seeing through it. And all you have to do is, you know, phase the unit into the camera and then it's gonna scan it. And then good thing about having this screen right in front of you was that we had visual guidance in terms of once they receive a product in, there was like a layout they would see on the screen, which would tell them exactly where to put that on the floor. So the layout they would see on the floor would match the layout they would see in that screen. So it's good to tell them exactly put in this spot. So it helped them with visual guidance as well, which also helped with the quality concerns as well. So
yeah, that is super cool. This is probably the most interesting and futuristic use of technology I've seen to solve like a problem. And the whole idea of making it very hands-free also probably helps, and it also removes a lot of the problems with like where to put the barcode camera that is usually fixed, right? In this case, mm-hmm. Now since you all decided that you don't want to really get the human touch completely out, you'd rather use the human touch and just they would just, you know, orient the product and just look at it. And yeah, that's pretty cool. So I really enjoyed that example, Abhishek. So thank you for sharing that. I think Ryder and you did a great job in, you know, providing a very elegant solution to something that could have become, you know, very, very capital intensive and huge with that MRI style, you know, system of cameras, which are used in many other, you know, places, like in assembly lines they are used. But then that is like very, very large pieces like cars, right? So kind of makes sense over there, and they have a very high volume also. Here, just to save 2 seconds, it was a great, you know, idea to just use something as small as these smartphone eyeglasses to take in something that is basically like a photograph, right? So essentially that you don't have to do any other thing. All it needs is a status check or an update on where this part has to end up. So a fantastic solution. So kudos to your team for thinking through it and applying something like this. Now, can you like explain to us, you know, in your line of work, there must be a lot of other non-technical issues, because there's a lot of project management, there's a lot of warehouse management, there is a lot of communication and scheduling and, you know, many such non-technical problems. So can you give us a challenge that you faced that wasn't entirely technical, but it gave you a hard time?
Sure. So again, it goes back to my current position at like Ryder. I would say we support the shipping side as well. So let's say orders come in from the customer, or let's say a retail store or garage work center, and the team which is called as bulk shipping is where an operator would get the order, and then they would go and start picking these products, and then these products would all go like on a big pallet per se, I would say, and then these pallets would be shipped either through like a line haul or final mile. This is a term we use. So for final mile is something which is, it will go directly to the end customer or whoever ordered this product. And final mile, line haul is basically, it means that these products from here would go from the distribution center to a cross-docking operation, from where it would be sorted further to be delivered directly to the end customer. So this was like a bulk shipping operation. So this is something, a problem I faced when I just joined the team. So the team was actually literally struggling with shipping the products on time. So there was a KPI which the team was monitored, which was on-time shipping KPI, which is a key performance indicator. The team was actually performing really bad. So the goal was actually 99.90, but they were at that point, they were at 96.9, so they were really behind, and the metric was really bad and red. And also not being able to ship these products on time, the customer, which is Verizon, was not at all happy at the time. So from a financial performance perspective, the team, the operation was also like losing a lot of, was spending a lot of money on labor, I would say. And the margins were also really bad, which was like negative 80%. So I wanted to look into this issue to see, you know, why the team was not able to ship products on time. And just because the team was not able to ship products on time, spent a lot of excess labor just to make sure they were able to ship the products, at least ship the products out, and which also led to excess overtime and then literally stressing the operators in that operation. So I started looking into this problem as to why the operation was not having a good financial performance, at the same time not being able to ship on time. So I started trying to understand what the problem was. So I used like a tool which Ryder uses, which is RCCM, which is root cause correct countermeasures. It's similar to an A3. So it was a problem to be solved. So trying to make sure the problem was understood accurately. And then I started working with the team to brainstorm as to what could be the potential causes for this problem. So we're trying to use tools like the cause and effect tool, trying to break it down into different causes as to why it was causing it to not ship the products on time. So there are a number of things that were identified. So there were some areas where there were gaps in the process. There was an area where there was an issue with accountability, as well as having a lack of problem solving mindset. So for the sake of this, I'll only focus on like accountability and lack of problem solving, just to make sure it's not technical. So the one issue I found in this operation is the operators used to pick something and then they would pick it and stage it for it to be loaded. So there used to be a lot of times where, and these pallets were actually being audited by the quality team to make sure the products were picked accurately, to ensure the customers were getting the right products. So what one big gap I saw was that there were a lot of errors that are found by these auditors, but there was no feedback going to these operators. So there was no way for the people who were picking to know if they were doing a good job or a bad job. So there was no feedback loop per se. And without having this feedback, they didn't know if they had to improve or they had to continue at the same pace. So I made sure that by working with the approved team members, there was a feedback process being put in as to whenever these defects were found, make sure that feedback went directly to the operator. So they knew that something had to be changed and then further look was required in terms of did the operator require more training or whatever that is. Not trying to blame the operator, but trying to find gaps in terms of is excess more training required or is there any other support required to ensure the operator was doing the right job. So there was another gap in terms of lack of problem solving. With this, what I say is whenever a picker used to go pick a product, whenever they came across an issue, they used to try to work around those problems rather than trying to alert the team leads or their supervisors, trying to work around it. And then what used to happen is if one operator faced that problem, most likely some other operator would come across the same problem just because that problem was not fixed in the first place. So it used to cause like a domino effect where things kept dragging, which ended up requiring more and more hours, which also ended up requiring excess overtime, and which is what was impacting performance. So, and I wasn't, and I wouldn't blame them, just because what used to happen is even though they used to explain those problems to the supervisors or team leads of that area, nothing used to happen. You know, there would be no actions. So over time, everyone just gave up, and then they would just walk around and then try to get as many orders as possible and then be done with it.
Like a lot of culture issue, like just the mindset issue that, you know, if this is a problem, instead of solving it, it used to just get pushed to the side and ignored. And then that, like you said, caused a lot of domino effects.
That's right. So, and again, the reason that used to happen is because even though those problems were, the operators explained those problems to the supervisors, and then maybe supervisors tried, you know, tried fixing that problem. There was no support from who was supposed to be supporting that, whether it be quality team or someone from engineering, which is where I was from, or it could be a system side, which is a warehouse management system. So if something was not set up correctly in the system, so over time, just because there were no actions, everyone just gave up and they all started working around it. But I knew that that was a big opportunity where if we knew those problems from the people who are actually working there, and if we started solving those problems one by one, over time we would be in a much better state. So what I did was I started, like, you know, we kind of added a task force per se, which is where if a problem came up, I created a tracker, which was something on SharePoint. So anytime a problem occurred, we started tracking it. I asked the operations team to track each and every time a problem occurred, and then made sure that I was looking into those problems, trying to categorize it into different buckets, doing a Pareto to ensure I was focusing on the right problems, and then working with the right team to actually get it resolved. And over time, once I started doing this and starting fixing more and more problems, then started giving that feedback to the operator saying, thanks for bringing up this problem. We looked into it and it was resolved. So you should no longer be seeing this issue. And if you do, please let us know again. So trying to get that feedback and trying to make these operators empower in terms of that you know, their ideas or suggestions are being considered and we are working on it to fix it. So that gave them more confidence, and the operations team started bringing more and more problems. And that's how the whole cycle began. So that's how the team was able to eliminate a lot of issues. And over time, the whole operation got into a much better state. So this was basically in 2018. In 2019, the team saw a drastic improvement in performance. The on-time shipping improved from 96.9% to almost 99.99%. Also, the margins, which is the margin, improved like 90% from 2018 to 2019, and then again 60% from 2019 to 2020. So there was a big drastic improvement just by looking into these two problems, which was with accountability as well as having a problem solving mindset as to fixing the problems as soon as it's occurred, and trying to give that feedback to the associates to let them know if they were doing a good job or if there were any gaps and if any training was required. So this is how I was able to tackle this problem in this operation.
That is very impressive, and the numbers were also very, you know, very telling of how big the change was. And this looked like 100% change management and culture change. You know, it's one of those problems in which you can't see anything wrong physically, and doing things requires like zero technical like insight or no tools or anything, but with a lot of like just showing up there, listening to people, finding what they have to say for the process and how it's going wrong, and then somebody actually takes that feedback and, you know, puts it into action is what really solved it. So, and you know, for the listeners, I'm sure, you know, this might be known to many people, but a Pareto chart is essentially used to divide all of your, it could be sales, and in Abhishek's case it was the issues happening in the warehouse, where 20% of the issues were causing 80% of the damage, right? So he basically used this chart to figure out what is it that he has to first hit at. And then he really looked at the accountability and the problem-solving mindset and made sure that this was, you know, a problem that they would take care of and not just work around, and also take down like a log in the SharePoint with what is happening, which are the problems, what is the severity, and so on and so forth. So one of these things that many, you know, engineers don't really consider, but this happens more often than the technical problems, which is all of these culture and attitude issues that are very, very hard to solve. Their change management is very hard. There are a lot of managers and, you know, supervisors who may not want or welcome that change. So I'd say, Abhishek, this is probably a more difficult task than your Google Glasses challenge, right? Because everyone was ready for a solution in that case. But in this case, you know, they may not be completely open, or they may not be completely amenable to someone like you coming in and saying that this has to be done this way, you need to solve it, and you need to start looking at it. So kudos to you again and the team for inculcating that culture. So a really good example as well. And thank you for sharing with us.
Yeah, and again, this is something I'm not going to take a credit for, because it was again a team effort, and it was only because of everyone and support from the team and willing to make a change, is because we were able to make this project a success. So yeah, I just want to make sure I put it out there.
Right, of course. But those numbers were nevertheless very impressive, you know, 90% differences in margin and so on and so forth. That's a great success story. So Abhishek, moving on to like the next question. If you had like a magic wand to change one thing about, you know, your industry or your job or your work or the whole field of manufacturing or supply chain, what would that be and why?
So this is an interesting question. So one thing I come across a lot by working in the supply chain industry. So let's say in a distribution center, we have these complicated warehouse management systems per se, and without which it's really difficult to get anything work, you know, in the right way. So these systems are really important. But a lot of times the challenges I face is just because the site is using a particular system or a warehouse management system, for example, a lot of times there are constraints within that system. With this, what I mean is a lot of times if I want a process to be designed a certain way, most likely that's not gonna happen just because the system works differently. And then most likely what's going to happen is I would have to change my process to match how the system is designed, rather than being it other way where the system should be designed around how the process should actually be. And then also just to make a certain change in the system, it requires so much effort we have to work with IT, like a whole IT team, which has developers, and it takes a lot of time and effort in terms of understanding how expensive it's going to be, how long it's going to be required to code something. So if there was only a way to make it easy where I could just build my own process and implement it in the system, and then things would work the way I really want it to be, rather than going through a whole IT team and coding these systems and trying to again work within the constraints of the system, just because that's how the system has been designed, and then me having to change the process to make it work around that system. So if there was a way to make it easy and very user-friendly where anyone, let's say in operations, could do it, it would be a big one. And it would also save a lot of time and effort and money, I would say, for a lot of teams, where they could just, let's say there was someone had an idea, we would just, you know, make that flow in the system and then just execute it, try it out. If it doesn't work, you iterate, you try it again, you make some changes. So having the continued feedback loop, and once you find the right flow, you just execute it and move it into production, and that's it. And rather than trying to go through these long processes where you design it and then you have to test it in test environment and then deploy it into production. So if there was a way to make that happen, I would say it would save a lot of time and effort to a lot of people.
So Abhishek, that's very exciting, because I do have something to say about it. But before I do, I want to understand it a little more. When you say that there are the system, you know, is different from like your process, does it mean that the system is different based on which client you're servicing, like on behalf of Ryder? Or by what do you mean that when you need a change, or if like, you know, it's not according to the process, like where is the change happening?
So when I mean system, it means, let's say we use a warehouse management system called Scale. So let's say a certain receiving process or a picking process would be designed in a certain way within that WMS system. But if I want to create my own process, or I want to...
Wait, I'm sorry. What is a WMS system?
It's a warehouse management system. So it's an MES, like a manufacturing execution system.
Right. Okay.
So, but that's something what we use in a distribution or warehousing operation. So having the system where if I want to create my own process, but if there is a similar process already in the system, I would have to make it such that my process is able... I have to change the process to make sure it matches the steps within that WMS system, I would say. just because that's how that WMS system has been designed, and there are constraints, and there's no way I can make it work based on how I really want that process to work, if you understood what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I completely understand what you're saying. So, well, Pashi is a manufacturing execution system, but the beauty of Pashi is that it's used wherever, you know, any kind of machine, like a device, like a barcode reader or like a packing machine or a conveyor is used, Pashi can be used in any of those locations. And the way the things are designed in Pashi is that you, as a person on the operation side, right, not a controls engineer or an IT engineer, but an operations person, would drag and drop these devices and connect them in the kind of flow that you need. And then wherever you think that, you know, there's a change in the process, or if there's a new client which operates things in a completely different way, and, you know, there's a different order to doing things in the warehouse, you have certain different systems, like, you know, maybe it's last in, first out, or now it's like first in, last out, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But you can then switch over your, you know, these blocks back and forth the way you want, and then just commit it the way you are, like, you know, giving a change to it. Like it's like a commit system in which if I make a change, everyone knows that this is the change that has been made. But if I think it's not good, I can always revert back to the previous version, or I can revert to any version that had been made so far by anybody, because all of that would be recorded. So it would be like a ledger of changes. And you could have these different versions, like as if it was a Google Docs with different version history. And you could just switch back and forth to whatever version you wanted. You could clone the line and just like use another line which was very similar, and then make changes if you just wanted everything, like 90% of it same, but you wanted to change only 10%. Plus, you could collaborate with your supplier, or in this case, like your customer, and they could see your like workflow in the same workspace, like our design view, at the same time as you, again, like a Google Docs, like avatar that would be visible. And it would be very easy. There would be no programming needed to design this workflow. But if you needed some custom logic, the Go programming language, which is, you know, a preferred language where you are talking to machines, it can be used by the IT team to embed this custom code, which might be very complicated, or it might be very one-off, but in general, it would be completely no code. So this is what Pashi does for all kinds of manufacturing operations. And although we haven't yet had any supply chain, you know, clients, mm-hmm. It's basically something that can be connected to any piece of hardware that has some controlling, you know, microchip or intelligence or PLC or any kind of device like barcodes or conveyors, like I said, or packing machines, or, you know, any of those devices. So, yeah, that is the whole intention of Pashi, is to make it very simple. You don't need the involvement of IT. You don't need the involvement of, like, controls engineers, except for when they are very specialized cases. So this is very interesting to me. And this was one of the core driving forces behind the creation of Pashi, is to make it very simple for the production engineer to change process logic as and when required.
Yep. So, yeah, I would say this would be great. On a warehousing or distribution side as well, having that flexibility and the power given to operations team to design something on their own rather than trying to work with someone outside who doesn't really understand how the process works. It would definitely help make the whole process efficient and faster, as well as have the team try out new ideas, you know, more frequently, rather than trying to be, you know, worried about how long it's going to take or how much money it's going to cost them to make a certain change. So, yeah, I would say this would be something that would really work for warehousing distribution side as well.
Fantastic. This is something I learned today. And, you know, supply chain within the four walls of the factory is also, you know, something in our, you know, consideration. But distribution, like by itself, like in a warehouse facility, is also a place where you test out many, many different process logics, is something I wasn't familiar with. So now I know, I've learned it from you. So thank you for that. And I think that was a great magic wand answer. It was very practical. It was very real. You know, it wasn't, you know, fantastical. It seemed like a real present problem. The magic wand can solve this quite easily. So yeah, great answer, Abhishek. And moving on, like, to this, you know, fifth surprise question that you probably don't know, or if you heard one of the episodes, maybe you do, is, you know, in 2051, if your grandchild were to enter a factory, or in your case, like a warehouse, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you could, you know, go forward in time to be in 2051 and see the warehouse of the future, what would it look like?
So maybe I can tackle warehouse. Maybe sure. You might have already heard of the factory examples from other people. So, and I would say my answer would not be very different from them. And again, a lot of these inspirations come from, I would say, science fiction movies. It's only because of ideas you get from these movies, a lot of things have been made possible because of that, is what I would say. So let's say in 2051, and that's, again, what I might say is not even 2051, it could be happening in like 5 to 10 years from now. So what I imagine is it's a whole, like a dark factory or dark distribution warehouse is what I would call it. When I mean dark, meaning no lights on, just because it's all robotics in there, where an order comes in and then things that just get picked up automatically, and then we just don't have to do anything. I would say there'll be just one person maybe monitoring that operation from a control tower per se, just in case if anything goes down or if there's any support required. Again, we could have robots fix different other robots as well, but I could say that we could have mechanics, those specialized technicians, just to fix those robots only if required. And then that's it. I mean, no activity at all, no humans, so all dark out. So you're again saving electricity is something I would say. And yeah, I mean, you just order something and then just products just comes out, and then you'll have drones flying all over just to deliver products. And then you never have to get out of your home. You can order everything from a smartphone or using a smart speaker or voice, I would say. And then it just stuff just gets delivered to your home, or not even home, I mean, you know, into your fridge, I would say. And that's something which is even happens in the current state. So I mean, that's what I can imagine 2051 could be. And again, not all industries, some industries might get there sooner than the others, but maybe by 2051 everyone, it would be a common scenario. For doesn't matter if it's a small medium-sized company or a large corporation, billion-dollar corporation, it could be something which is a common or by like given by default, like. So that's what I can imagine of what 2051 would be.
Yeah, that's very close to what I think also, Abhishek. And I've heard of the term dark factory already. So it's, you know, people are already thinking about those kind of benefits, right? No heating, no electricity, none of that required, no aisles, you know, really needed other than for the AGVs or, you know, guided vehicles. So no safety incidents also. So lots of benefits, especially with warehousing. I feel that it might come there faster in a warehouse than in machining or in assembly or something like that, simply because there are a lot of things that do not even need human finessing with warehousing. If they are basically routing of material, or they're storing or stacking of lots of boxes, this can be probably achieved faster in a warehouse than in a factory. So absolutely, that's a great answer there. And drones, again, people are already investing in it. Some of them have experimented with it. So again, like you said, this could be possible for at least for warehouses in the next like 10 years or so. So
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, great.
I'm already seeing these examples through concept videos and all. So it could be faster than, you know, for certain industries and companies, yes, it's going to be sooner. But there'll be like smaller companies which might take time to get there at accepting the new technology. It's going to take a while. So yeah, maybe by 2051, by default, everyone would begin that way, is what I would say.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed this conversation. I enjoyed all of your answers. I learned so much about the warehousing problems and the warehousing industry and how work is done and how, you know, third-party solutions are used by, you know, large companies like Verizon, and you guys are the ones, you know, behind the scenes making sure that the packages, you know, get returned or, you know, refunded and whatnot on time, or even shipped, you know, the new stuff. And we don't think much about it when we go back to the Verizon store or the T-Mobile store, or, you know, and give something back. And that's where, you know, your team and Ryder really spring into action with all of these improvements, right? So the Google Glass example and that change management example was very nice to hear. And it was great getting in touch with you again. And thank you so much for giving the time to come on the episode.
Thanks, Arida. I enjoyed the conversation as well. And I'm glad you learned a lot from this. And I'm sure I learned a lot as well, especially from, like, you know, hearing about Pashi. So I'm really excited to see where would Pashi go in terms of trying to solve problems for other industries as well, like supply chain or any other industry per se. So looking forward to that as well.
And good luck. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe we might be on a call with you.
For sure. Yeah. Good luck with your journey as well to make it happen.
Awesome. All right. See ya.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to the Means of Production podcast for more stories from people behind all the manufactured goods we use, love, and depend on. This episode was made possible by Pashi, the operating system for manufacturing. Pashi unifies the entire production process for any product, encompassing operator instruction and data input interfaces, stage logic and parameter thresholding, machine interfacing and configuration, robot programming and coordination, and stage-to-stage production flow control into a single Pashi program. Check us out at pashi.com. And until we meet again, have a fantastic day and take care.